Our Sense of Place series on Memphis continues with more about Stax Records and an interview recorded with Booker T and the MGs guitarist Steve Cropper in 2005. He started recording at Stax in the house band and later went on to work closely with Otis Redding. I started out asking him what his parents thought when, as a teenager, he decided to be a musician.
My parents were very supportive of me, the band. My dad, we got off from work, go to a gig, he'd help load the drums and all that. They were totally supportive of that. They never went negative on me about any of that, about, well, you're not going to make it, or you don't have a chance of doing this, and if you do, you're not going to be anybody. But they were very supportive, and I think that was a big plus, and it helped. And I just moved right along. I was very fortunate. I started getting serious about it when I was 14.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote some songs. I had a little instrumental that I wrote. And I got a buddy of mine in school who actually read music to notate it. And I was over at his house one day, and his dad, B.B. Cunningham, came home, and he worked for Sam Phillips at Sun Records. And he said, "Hey, what's that?" And he said, "Oh, it's a little thing that Steve wrote, and I'm making a lead sheet for him. He's going to copyright this song." He said, "Hey, that's pretty neat little melody." He said, "You mind if I put that on recorder?" And he took it to a guy named Bill Justice. And Bill had just come off of, what, 2 number one records in the nation, was big on Dick Clark and all that. And he loved it, and he recorded it, brought me down to sign the contracts on it on a Saturday with my dad. I was 15 years old. And I got my first royalty check when I was 16 years old. It's like hitting the lottery. So, I mean, it was a small check. I wish I'd saved it, but it was a small check. But to me, it was like it could have been, you know, the biggest check in the world. And I went, that's what I want to do the rest of my life. So
now,
I tried.
Were you still in high school when the Marquise had Last Date, which was 61?
We had already graduated from high school.
Mm-hmm.
So we're a little older than we think. we graduated in 59, and Last Night with the Marquise was 61. So we'd been out there trying to hit it pretty good and been on the road. And so we had that record. It was number 3 in the nation, I think, on Billboard.
Our guest is Steve Cropper here on the World Cafe today, and that's, well, as we've just heard, not Steve's first recorded song, certainly, but the first big hit for the Marquise, and that was last night.
How about that sustaining note? Isn't that incredible? Get paid for one note.
Well, at about that time was when, as people keep describing it, Jim Stewart kind of gave you the keys to Stax Studios. And I think what people may not understand is how much of a mom-and-pop business Stax was in those days. Is that a good way to describe it?
That's a good way to describe it. And I think the reason I was brought in is just basically I was honest. And I was somebody that Jim Stewart and Estelle both could trust. Estelle actually put me to work selling records up in the record shop, Satellite Record Shop. And, of course, she owed me a favor because I put her son in our band. We had a pretty good little band working around town with no horns, and he came to me one day at school and said, "I want to be in your band." And I said, "We're not looking for any new members. What do you do?" And he said, "I play saxophone." I went, "Well, we're not really looking for horns." I said, "How long you been playing?" He said, "Oh, I've been taking lessons for 3 months." Oh, boy, this is good. And somewhere in the conversation, he said that his uncle and his mother owned a recording studio. And I said, "What are you doing Saturday morning?" So we had Packy, Charles Axton. His nickname was Packy. And Packy showed up for rehearsal, and, God, he was screeching. But you know what? It was music to our ears because every Sunday— we used to go out to the studio that his uncle had and his mother, and we would play. And, of course, his uncle thought we didn't have a chance in a hailstorm. We'd never make it.
Well, I'd like to play a couple things, including, of course, one of your most famous co-writes, which is the one with Otis Redding on Dock of the Bay. And maybe if you could just lead us through a little bit of this. I mean, there's some incredible guitar playing on this. It just kind of sets the whole tone of the song. And what kind of a co-write was it? How did it work out?
Well, let me just start by saying that Otis never got to hear the final version of this song.
Right.
It's very sad and unfortunate. He called me from the airport so excited and wanted to know that I was in the studio. Otherwise, he would have gone on to the hotel. I knew he was coming in, but he started showing me this thing. I left my home in Georgia. So, man, this is it. So we sat there. I think it probably took me about maybe 20 minutes to put it together, and I wrote the bridge with him. Looks like nothing's going to change. Everything remains the same. I can't do what 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll remain the same, y'all. And he said, that's it, man, that's it. So we went in the next day and recorded that song. Mm. And he wants the seagull sounds. He's going, caw, caw, caw. And I said, man, it sounds like a crow. It doesn't sound like a seagull. And I had a little, for all those people out there, listen, he says, I watch the ships come in, and then I watch them roll away again. And I said, Otis, I said, ships don't roll. If they roll, they'll sink. He said, no, crap, that's the way I want it. I want it. I want them rolling in. And it took me years to figure out. He was talking about the ferries. He was talking about the way the ferries come in. You know how they dock and they roll the water in as they dock so the cars and people can get off? That's what he was talking about. At the time we recorded it, I still disagreed with him about watching ships roll. But anyway, and like I said, he didn't get to hear the final product. But I know he's still up there listening and very proud of it. And God bless Otis, wherever you are, my man.
Listen, 2,000 miles I roam just to make this dock my home. Now I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.
The late Otis Redding, Dock of the Bay. Steve Cropper is our guest. Steve, we're going to let you head off, but I wanted to set something straight because I was a little curious myself of some things I was reading about. Obviously, Booker T and the MGs' first big hit was Green Onions. Well, first of all, people have made a point about how quietly important it was that Booker T and the MGs were, you know, two black guys, two white guys playing together in a band in the early 1960s. Did that feel important to you guys? Did it feel unusual at all to you guys?
The funny thing is we didn't know that. That's not what we saw. As far as I know, the whole time I was at Stax Records, there was absolutely zero color. Everybody came in there equal through those doors, and it literally was like going to church every day. Or, you know the feeling when you go to grandma's house? You just feel like, as a kid, you go to grandma's house, you're so safe, you know you're going to get a good meal, you know you're going to get tucked in a great place to sleep and all that. So walking through those doors at Stax Records was that feeling. It was like going to church every Sunday. You felt this camaraderie of safeness, and everybody was there for the same purpose, and everybody was helping everybody out.
Well, that's an important point. But the point I wanted to clarify was about Green Onions. I've heard two things. One, that it was a jam to begin with, and number two, that it was recorded after you guys had done a jam, and I didn't know which one of those was true.
Second part probably more the truth, because we had just jammed on the flip side of that record. Called Behave Yourself. We were waiting on an artist to record with. Billy Lee Riley was his name. And he didn't show. And so we were jamming on some blues. So Jim Stewart had the tape ready to go and all that, so he just pushes the recording button. We had no idea he was recording. So he said, hey, guys, come and hear this. And we go, what? So he plays it, and we go, that's pretty good. And he said, well, if you guys got anything you could, if we put this out, is there anything you could put on the B side? And we all sort of looked dumbfounded. We're going, is Jim Stewart serious or what? Well, we guess he was. So we all looked dumbfounded. I didn't have anything. And it just came to mind. I said, Booker, I said, you remember that riff you played me a couple of weeks ago? And went, he said, oh, yeah, yeah. So he goes out on the organ and he starts playing this riff. And two cuts later, we have Green Onions that you know about today.
That interview with Steve Cropper was recorded in 2005. In 2009, I got a chance to talk with the man himself, Booker T, about that hit and about working at Stax Records in Memphis. To begin, I asked Booker T if he concentrated on playing the Hammond B3 organ because of Green Onions.
I ended up being known as an organist because that was my first hit record. I didn't actually concentrate on the organ. I might have found my best musical voice with the organ, though.
Definitely, definitely. We had a chance to talk with Steve Cropper about the days working with the Stewarts and working at Stax.
Yeah.
And it just sounds like a wonderful creative environment.
It was.
And what were your various roles that you did? Did you actually lead the band? I mean, obviously it's Booker T and the MGs, but I'm wondering how that worked.
I had a lot of different roles. I was the only one that could write music, so I did the lead sheets for the publishing company. Very often I did the charts when necessary. And they used me as, I might have ended up playing tuba or trombone or tambourine. I ended up moving around the studio on a lot of different instruments because I enjoyed it and because I could. I played harmonica and I played a little bit of guitar and piano.
My understanding is while you were doing that, you went to school and got a music education degree at the same time?
Yeah, a lot of driving between Indiana and Tennessee.
Uh-huh. Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, now I'm curious about your parents because they seemed to instill a whole lot in you from an early age, and about your musical education in Memphis, because you had to learn how to play Barry early on and all these instruments. Was there a lot of music in the schools?
My parents made it possible. My dad was the patient guy that drove me to the clubs at night, drove me to the gigs out in the country over in Arkansas, and paid for the clarinet, carried all the instruments in his trunk, and my mother gave me the musical soul, the inspiration. She provided the example on the piano. She played Chopin, Liszt, Prokofiev, and she played gospel music, and they made it all possible.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So there was a piano in the house?
There was a piano in the house, my grandmother's piano. Uh-huh.
And what was it like first time you switched over to playing an organ? Because it's a completely different hand technique, isn't it?
My piano teacher had an organ in her dining room. And I took piano lessons for a long time before I realized that that wooden cabinet in the dining room was not a break front with china in it because she had the top down, so I couldn't see the keys. When I finally asked what it was, she opened it up and played a few notes and told me this was a Hammond organ. And that's when I just became smitten with that thing.
Now, when you left the MGs and... actually, you left Memphis. You ended up moving to Southern California.
Yeah.
And you did a lot of production work. What were some of the? I know you did Bill Withers. Did you concentrate on production work, or did you want to work as a sideman, or how did that?
Well, it was an uncomfortable situation. I left Memphis, and I basically needed a job when I came to California, and I met Leon Russell, and I met Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss, and I basically needed work. So I started working as an arranger out there, and I met Quincy Jones, and he showed me some of the ropes and showed me around Hollywood some, and then I started producing out there.
And making solo records.
And making solo records, uh-huh, yeah.
And then that's records with Priscilla, who was then your wife.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And... had a whole career going. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a story I heard from T-Bone Burnett, who you worked with on the Bruce Coburn, couple of his albums, that he had your business card from selling real estate on his mantle.
Yeah,
you were doing that to supplement for a while, or
in the early 80s, when the interest rates went up to 23-24% in the United States, the music business just fell apart. The record companies had spent all their money, and there was just no money in music, and I couldn't pay my bills. So I got a real estate license, and I started selling real estate in Southern California.
Did people realize who was selling their house?
Yeah, they did. A lot of them. Some of them did. Uh-huh, yeah.
That's funny.
I'm realizing I was just looking at the at dates because Green Onions is a song that has always been part of my musical life, and,
yeah.
and I really wasn't sure when it came out.
Yeah,
but so it came out in '62.
Yeah, it came out in the late spring of '62.
Uh huh. And what was the story? It was a B-side. It was.
Oh yeah, yeah. It was supposed to be a B-side for "Behave Yourself," which was the A-side. That was a blues that we were playing on organ, and we needed something for the A for the B-side. And Green Onions is a little riff that I'd been playing on piano that I ended up playing on a little organ just to fill in the record, yeah, just to fill out the the other side.
Well, so let's see. So 62, so you were 18.
Just about 18.
Wow.
I turned 18 in November that year.
And do you remember what happened with it? Do you remember how it grew, how it grew as a record?
I took off. I started getting ready to go to Indiana University. I didn't pay too much attention to it. I really liked the way it sounded, but I was focused on being a freshman at Indiana at the time and getting money together for the tuition and clothes and driving up there, and that was my focus right then.
You've been playing this song for a long time. Could we get one more out of you?
I don't get tired of it.
Really?
Not that one.
Thank you.
Green Onions live with Booker T and his band, recorded in 2009. Our World Cafe Sense of Place visit to Memphis continues on the World Cafe.